Welcome back, everyone. We're about to start the second hour of Ira David Wood III's Confessions of an Elf. As promised, we're taking about a 5 or 6 minute break here. If you need to go somewhere, go ahead and go. If not, sit tight, listen up. Robin Bullock is going to entertain us with a little more music from Guitar for Christmas. Thank you.
A Dickens of a Day. A Christmas family party? We know nothing in nature more delightful. There seems a magic in the very name of Christmas. Charles Dickens. The weather in Manchester, England, can sometimes seem especially cold and bleak. The particular October day that begins this story was definitely one of those times. Winter was in the air. The merciless wind seemed unusually harsh and damp. People trudged up and down the streets with heads bowed against the bitterness of it. No one smiled. At least the sun was still up. That was one consolation. Of course, you couldn't really see it through the heavy layer of gray clouds. Still, just knowing it was there seemed to help. A little. When night finally came to this particular city, on this particular day, the cheeriness of what little daylight there had been faded completely from the sky. The street emptied quickly as the people of Manchester hurried home without a sound. When, at last, the icy darkness had wrapped itself around the quiet streets and buildings of the town, the whole world seemed to take a deep, collective breath before sinking into a long and lingering depression. All together. All at once. Now, there was an undeniable ray of hope ahead, something to look forward to, if people had only realized it. Christmas was coming, and, as everyone knows, Christmas is the happiest day of the year. Yet, judging by the dreariness of the day, the empty streets and the silence of that cold, lonely night, you would hardly have known it. But then, that was probably because no one hardly did know it. You see, the year was 1843, and a few things we take for granted now were very, very different then. A Christmas card or two might have reminded a few people to cheer up a bit, but no one ran to the mailbox to see who might have sent them one. There wasn't much need to do so. Christmas cards weren't introduced to the world until 1846. That meant that on this particular evening in Manchester, England, Christmas cards, and all the wonderful cheer that might have come along with them, were still 3 long years away. Even if there had been Christmas cards in 1843, they wouldn't have changed the fact that there still wasn't very much Christmas to look forward to anyway. It might be hard for you to imagine, but this was a time when December 25th was hardly noticed. One day holiday. It came and went without much fanfare at all. Littles might hope to get a couple of presents apiece, of course, but that was about it. On Christmas Day, the Biggles simply sat around the house and read, which, when you got down to it, wasn't so very different from what they did almost every other day of the year. It's very safe to say that if anyone thought about Christmas at all in 1843, the word festive wasn't the first thing to pop into their minds. But the shocking fact that Christmas came and went without too much notice didn't really affect people one way or the other. After all, they had no way of knowing that they were missing something. If something extra special hadn't happened, we'd probably all still be celebrating Christmas just this very same way, which is to say we wouldn't be celebrating Christmas very much at all. The world had just settled in for that long, cold October evening when the sound of footsteps broke the empty silence. A lone man, shielded against the weather by a top hat, warm scarf, and long cloak, came into view. Making his solitary way along the deserted streets of the town, he seemed wrapped as much in deep thought as he was by that long, warm cloak against the evening chill. Occasionally, he would pause before the glow of a lighted window to gaze inside. His eyes would carefully absorb the typical scene within, a family gathered around the evening fire, a small child playing idly with a favorite toy, someone silently reading by candlelight. For a moment, he would take it all in. Then, with a sigh and a shrug, he would eventually resume his quiet and lonesome promenade. He appeared to be the only living soul foolish enough to venture outside that evening, and yet, despite the season's icy chill and the solitary nature of his journey, he seemed quite content in having the night all to himself. He was just passing through a pool of light cast by the occasional friendly blaze of a street lamp when a man's soft voice interrupted his thoughts. "Evening, sir." A bit startled, the man in the top hat and long cloak paused to peer into the darkness just beyond the light. "Good evening yourself," was his reply. Another gentleman, also warmly dressed against the evening's chill, stepped into the street lamp's friendly glow. "Well," said the man in the top hat and cloak, "I hardly expected to find anyone else on the street tonight." "Yes, I know," the stranger replied with a friendly smile. For a moment the two men simply gazed at each other in comfortable silence. Then the stranger spoke again. "You're Charles Dickens, aren't you?" he said. The man in the top hat and cloak smiled. "I am," he answered. "I've read your work," continued the stranger. "You've quite a talent as a writer." Charles Dickens, the man in the top hat and coat, was 31 years old, and on this particular evening in Manchester, England, he had already achieved extraordinary status as a writer. His books were beginning to be read and loved the world over. By this time in his career, he had completed Oliver Twist, Nicholas Nickleby, and The Old Curiosity Shop, among others. Yet he was still, as they say, poised on the threshold of greatness. "I've certainly no wish to intrude," the stranger continued, "but I see you're walking alone. Would you care for some company?" Dickens considered for a moment. Usually on these solitary jaunts, he preferred to be by himself. But something in the stranger's voice and smile softened his resolve. "As a matter of fact," he said, "I'd very much appreciate some company this evening, Mr.—" "Nicholas," replied the stranger. "Well, Mr. Nicholas," the great author said with a sigh, "you and I seem to be the only two people brave enough to be stirring abroad on a night like this. That being the case, I believe we'd be only prudent to follow the adage which advises that misery not only needs, but rather enjoys, company." And that's the way they met, Charles and Nicholas, on a cold and dreary October evening in Manchester, England, under the warm glow of a street lamp. And what followed was one of those pivotal but unrecorded moments in history, when the course of human thought is irrevocably altered due to a passing and perhaps unintended act or deed. They walked together for hours, these two men, for probably 20 miles, up and down the deserted streets of an empty city. And they spoke of things, important things, thoughts that shape the life of a man, dreams that tend to forge a soul destined for greatness. The two men had walked silently abreast for a while when Nicholas again broke the silence. "Mr. Dickens, I hope you don't mind me saying so," he began, "but you seem somehow troubled this evening. May I ask why?"
"Is it that obvious?" Dickens asked, adjusting the collar of his long cloak to better shield himself from the wind.
Nicholas simply kept silent pace with his newfound companion. "As it so happens, I am troubled," Dickens confessed. "I feel as if the cares of the entire world were weighing down upon me tonight."
"Quite a burden," Nicholas said softly. "The cares of the entire world? I hope you have strong shoulders, sir."
"It's not shoulders I need," snapped Dickens. "It's making a difference that's vital, and I must confess to you that as a writer I am this evening feeling somewhat inadequate to the task."
"What sort of difference do you wish to make?" asked Nicholas.
Dickens stopped walking. He didn't say anything for a moment, but only stared straight into the darkness ahead. Suddenly he turned to Nicholas with a new sense of purpose. "I've recently come from London," he explained. "From Field Lane, as a matter of fact, a rather raggedy charity school for children in Saffron Hill."
"Ah, yes," Nicholas sighed. "I happen to know it well."
"Then you also must know that what a deplorable place it is," Dickens continued with growing enthusiasm. "Well-meaning, but totally inadequate."
"Yes," Nicholas replied. "As a matter of fact, I do know."
Again there was another thoughtful silence as the two men continued together down the quiet street.
"If I'm not mistaken," Nicholas began again, "isn't Field Lane located on the very same spot Fagin occupied in Oliver Twist?"
Dickens stopped in his tracks and turned to face his walking companion. Again he couldn't help but smile.
"You have a rather good memory for details," Dickens observed wryly.
"So I've been told," Nicholas chuckled. "In this case, however, I much prefer to think of it as merely having the good sense to recognize a brilliant writer when I read one." Another moment slipped quietly by until the silence was broken again by Nicholas. "You really do want to change the world, don't you?" he asked, placing a hand on his new friend's shoulder. The gleam in the eyes of Charles Dickens was all the answer he needed. "In that case," Nicholas concluded, "why don't you get on with it?" Charles Dickens gazed intently at the man before him and offered a reply that his excused and haunted mankind's apathy for ages past and ages to come.
"What difference can I possibly make?" he implored. "I'm only one man against an apathetic world."
Dickens shoved his hands into the pockets of his long cloak and fretfully paced back and forth for a moment. "Do you realize," he finally continued, "that in our country today only one child out of three attends even a rudimentary school? Thousands of children never attend school at all. And it's not simply that they can't afford it. They're not allowed to afford it."
"Yes, I know," Nicholas replied evenly. "And that is why I still ask, when do you plan to get on with changing things for the better?"
Dickens, in one grand gesture of helplessness, threw back his head and flung his arms wide. "For God's sake, man," he cried in his best orator's voice,
I write books. I entertain the masses for a few short hours. At best, if I occupy their minds at all, it is to direct their attention away from the cares and problems of the world. No one wishes to see the world as it truly is. They only want to see what they imagine it to be. I beg your pardon, Nicholas replied with just a tinge of firmness in his voice. I must have been mistaken. I was under the impression that I was addressing the author of Oliver Twist, a novel that, as I recall, dealt quite remarkably with the injustices society all too often inflicts upon the children of this world. I believe you to be a man who used the power of his creative gifts to help raise the level of that same society's collective consciousness. I imagine you to be the sort of man who would still might wish to do more, if he could. You're a writer. You know the power of the written word. What has changed your mind? The question brought Dickens to a standstill. For a moment, he could only stare blankly into the eyes of his companion. Nicholas returned the gaze with a comfortable and disarming smile. Finally, the great author spoke. My present situation, he said in a soft reply, is what has changed my mind. In what way? Asked Nicholas. Dickens sighed deeply and began again. You say I have a talent as a writer, and that my talent has the power to change the lives of others, to make the world a better place for the rest of humanity? That very well may be. But tell me, sir, what good is that to me when I myself am hard-pressed to provide for the basic needs of my family? They cannot clothe themselves in my talent. They cannot be housed in it. You do not set talent on the table for an evening meal. The simple truth is that I am desperate for money. I have debts, you see, financial obligations to my family, my publisher, my creditors. Setting down the truth on paper is a great satisfaction to my soul. That is its value to me. But if the truth cannot also put meat upon my table, what is it finally worth? That is why I no longer sit at my desk, pen in hand, asking my soul if what I am writing is true. Now I merely ask myself if what I am writing will sell. If silence has ever seemed deafening, it seemed so in that one moment. Even in the dim glow of that distant street lamp, Nicholas could plainly see the grief in Dickens' eyes. "May I ask you a question?" said Nicholas finally. Dickens did not reply. "If one day, while walking along the Thames, you were to see a child accidentally fall into the water, what would you do?" The question immediately returned Dickens' gaze to Nicholas. "Would you," Nicholas continued, "leap into the water to try to save the child? Or would you pause to consider what the worth of the deed might be to you? Would you need, as well, a moment to consider the value of your actions?" Nicholas let the unanswered question hang for a long time in the icy silence of the night. Dickens stood ramrod straight, boring into him with blazing eyes. "Perhaps," Nicholas went on, "you would also need a moment to consider the possible effects of your deed upon the lives of your family. After all, what if, in the attempt to save that child, you were to lose your own life? And surely you would have to consider how your publisher or creditors would ever be repaid. And so, when you had asked yourself all of these questions, after you had taken pause to carefully compare the worth of the deed against its value, and only when your soul was quite satisfied with the answers, would you then try to save the drowning child?" Dickens remained frozen before Nicholas for a moment or two. Then, all at once, the great author's chest rose, fell, and actually seemed to shudder beneath the weight of the enormous and unspeakable emotion. "I suggest to you," Nicholas concluded with quiet gentleness, "that at this very moment thousands of the world's children are drowning in a great river of neglect, loneliness, and despair, and for reasons that escape your poor powers of human comprehension, God has chosen to place you, my good sir, on the river bank. Now you may, if you so choose, take the luxury of time for consideration. I only hope you find your answers before the cries of those children have been silenced forever. After all, answers are easy, Mr. Dickens, only the questions are hard." A very wise person once said that the greatest moments in our lives happen during the silences. So it was that in the ensuing silence of that cold October night, Charles Dickens, the greatest author of his time, quietly and freely wept. Every mystery of the world has a solution. All of life's great questions were answered long before we ever even began to consider them. Each answer, each solution lies, simply hidden, in the hearts of man. They have been within us from the beginning of time. All too frequently, however, we lose the discovery of truth in the self-imposed complexity of our desperate search to find it. In our long and arduous journeys to reach paradise, we awake to discover, often too late, they've already passed through it many times. The real quest of the human soul has never been to find the right answers. The true quest has always been to simply determine whether you're asking the right questions. In that instant of absolute clarity, when this marvelous realization swept over Dickens, he was immediately and completely transformed. He wept, yes, but he wept for joy. He felt at once the wonderful release from the terrible bondage of too many excuses and too much rationalization. In only one more remarkable moment, his tears gave way to laughter. Happy, uncontrollable, side-splitting laughter. Nicholas laughed, too. They both laughed together. They laughed until their sides ached and they were out of breath. When they could laugh no longer, the two men, arm in arm, joyously resumed their night-long walk through the dark streets of Manchester. For Dickens, now so miraculously transformed, the night seemed to become fresh and new as well, taking on a special aura all its own, the radiance which reached down into the innermost depths of his soul, illuminating his entire being with lustrous light of hope. The author, grasping a newfound joy in this fresh sense of purpose, became exuberant. His feelings of emotions, held inside for so long, came pouring out like a flood. He began to tell Nicholas all about his life, of his childhood partially spent on London's Baham Street, of his crippled son, Tiny Fred, so named for Dickens' own brother, who was only 2 years old when their family had moved to England's great capital city. As each long-buried recollection surfaced, Dickens would eagerly describe that memory's particular story to Nicholas. With wonderfully animated gestures, he captured and unfolded tale after tale, assuming with the master storyteller's practiced skill this or that marvelous character from his past. As they walked, even his footsteps on the cobblestones seemed to become increasingly brisk and light. 5 miles turned to 10, 10 miles turned to 20, before the night was spent. And all during their time together, Nicholas stayed close by his side, listening in rapt attention as the great author healed his heart through the simple magic of his own remembrances. Only when Dickens finally lapsed into happy silence did Nicholas dare to speak again. When he finally did, he began slowly and deliberately, not wishing to break the evening's fresh spell. "Charles," he said with a newfound familiarity, "when you write again, why not set down these stories you've just shared with me? Why not write about the things you know and feel so deeply?" Dickens, pausing to draw a breath, considered his friend's proposal. "My stories?" he said aloud, repeating the idea to himself. "Of course," Nicholas urged with a smile. "Why not?" Only then, for the first time since Dickens began to laugh earlier that evening, did the two men stop walking. The author turned to face Nicholas once more. "You've not really been searching for the truth, Charles," Nicholas confided. "You've simply been searching for yourself, for the child you used to be. You've been seeking a way to go back, to heal the hurt you knew. For a time, you were lost, but tonight you found the way. I believe the door to the past and all of its priceless wonders has been opened to you. Life is short, and this doesn't happen for everyone. So please don't stand too long on the threshold. Go in. Go back to what you were, to that little boy with all of his hurts, his hopes, his wonderful dreams. You'll find him there. He's been waiting for you." "And then what?" Dickens probed. "What do I do then?" Nicholas patted his friend's shoulder before starting off into the night. "You're a writer," he called out over his shoulder. "What do you think you do?" "But how?" Dickens pleaded. "Where do I begin?" "You'll think of something," Nicholas cried, waving a cheerful goodbye to his friend as he sauntered away. "If it's any help to you, Christmas is just around the corner." "That's it," Dickens called out. "The merriest Christmas ever." Nicholas paused briefly, cocking an eyebrow, added with a departing smile, "Wouldn't be at all surprised. Oh, and that reminds me, Charles. Heard any good Christmas carols lately?" In another second, Nicholas had vanished, disappearing completely into the pre-dawn darkness as suddenly as he had appeared. He left the rejuvenated author practically riveted to his spot on the sidewalk, a quizzical look spreading across his face as the first rays of sunlight began to streak the clear skies over Manchester, England. Charles Dickens' book, A Christmas Carol, published by Chapman and Hall solely on the basis of a commission, appeared in the London bookstores on Christmas Day, 1843. It had taken the author only a little over 6 weeks to compose the entire story. Bound in red cloth with a beautiful gilt design on the cover, it sold 6,000 copies the first day alone. It became one of the most beloved stories in the English language, one of the greatest books of all time. The very first stage adaptation of A Christmas Carol, premiered in 1844, only a year after the book was published. To date, at least 40 film versions, dozens of recordings, and several television adaptations have celebrated the transformation of the mean-spirited old miser whose confrontation with the past and future transforms him in a single night to a new person. The original manuscript of the book was carefully preserved and, after many wanderings, is now part of the Pierpont Morgan Library in New York, where it's exhibited to thousands of people every year. Robert Seymour, the great Dickens biographer, once suggested that Charles Dickens actually invented Christmas. It isn't true, of course, and everyone knows it. It is safe to say, however, that Dickens' little book did help revive the celebration of Christmas, not only in England but throughout the entire world. He achieved this miracle by simply taking his readers back to the child within themselves. He reminds us all, in a unique and loving way, that the true spirit of Christmas is actually a shared sense of childhood, a special time of active usefulness, perseverance, cheerful discharge of duty, kindness and forbearance, a time of personal recommitment to the dreams we hold so dearly within our hearts, the universal desire for true and lasting peace on earth, goodwill toward men. Dickens' wonderful book gave those dreams a voice and still reminds us that they are attainable after all. And yet, more than the beautiful story itself, the unique quality of his personal passion for the subject is what gave the book its true and lasting greatness. Because in the writing of A Christmas Carol, it was as if Dickens, through the character of Ebenezer Scrooge, actually returned to his own childhood and relived it. In doing so, he swept his readers along. His journey, his healing, became theirs as well. Long before we ever derived a clinical name for the process, before we ever began to understand the therapeutic value, Dickens already knew instinctively that such spiritual journeys are much a part of life and growth as breath itself. In fact, he explains it very well in his own words when he writes, "There are people who will tell you that Christmas is not to them what it used to be, that each succeeding Christmas has found some cherished hope, a happy prospect of the year before, dimmed or passed away, that the present only serves to remind them of reduced circumstances and straitened incomes, of the feast they once bestowed on hallowed friends, and of the cold looks that meet them now in adversity and misfortune. Never heed such dismal reminiscence. There are few men who have lived long enough in the world who cannot call up such thoughts a day and a year. They do not select the merriest of the 365 for your doleful recollections, but draw your chair nearer the blazing fire. Fill the glass and send round the song. And if your room be smaller than it was a dozen years ago, or if your glass be filled with reeking punch instead of sparkling wine, put a good face on the matter, and empty it off hand, and fill another, and troll off the old ditty you used to sing, and thank God it's no worse. Who can be insensible to the outpourings of good feeling and the honest interchange of affectionate attachment which abound at this season of the year? A Christmas family party. We know nothing in nature more delightful. There seems a magic in the very name of Christmas." In the writing of A Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens used everything his memory could possibly reach back to touch. The Dickens family home on Bayham Street became the small terraced house inhabited by the Cratchit family. His own brother, Tiny Fred, became the story's Tiny Tim. Scrooge's obsession with material wealth had been his own. As Dickens had purged it in his own life, so Scrooge did in his story. It wasn't by accident that Scrooge's extraordinary journey back to the past began with the appearance of Christmas spirit. For the rest of his days, Charles Dickens knew there was more to that part of the story than most people ever imagined.
All I want for Christmas. Most of the time, the whole year round, there ain't no flies on me, but just for Christmas, I'm as good as I can be. Eugene Field. It's not often that Santa Claus makes a mistake. When he does, it's usually an unqualified doozy. For instance, he never thought hula hoops were going to be so popular. Of course, that may be due to the fact that the boss could hardly fit one of them around his middle. Pet rocks? He couldn't believe how well they went over. I mean, after all, he predicted most of the world's other fads with astonishing accuracy. That's why it's always such a kicker whenever some unqualified hit manages to slip by him. When it does happen, and the boss realizes he's missed the bullseye by that old proverbial mile, he paces around the toy shop, shaking his head and chuckling to himself. Sometimes he'll mutter something like, "A pet rock? A rock? Go figure that." Of course, we elves always pretend we don't notice. We try very hard, but it's a losing cause. As surely as the sun will rise tomorrow, one of us eventually giggles out loud, usually me. Then everybody loses it. The boss laughs at himself, harder, louder, and longer than anyone else. By the way, having 100 to 200 belly laughs a day is the equivalent of a high-impact workout, burning off up to 500 calories. North Pole Company rule. We always have lots of fun, most especially when we make mistakes. It's not just healthy for elves or people to take themselves too seriously all the time. Now, I should make it very clear that those of us who work for the boss aren't in the fad business. Of course, we gear our assembly line towards producing what people ask for, but we're also natural observers of human behavior. We have to be. We're absolutely mesmerized at how you determine what will or what won't become a fad in the first place. It's certainly no secret to elves that Americans comprise only 5% of the world's population and yet consume 25% of its natural resources. After all, we've read your Christmas wish lists. Our own personal curiosity aside, fads have an enormous impact on the whole holiday gift-giving process. We produce what people ask for, and people, unfortunately, tend to ask for what's popular with everyone else. In the vernacular of the marketing world, a fad is anything that's hot. For something to be considered hot, it has to be either chic, current, hip, fashionable, trendy, popular, smart, or in vogue. How about a quarter for every time a salesperson ever said to you, "Everybody's wearing this"? Anything can become a fad, and I mean anything. Swallowing live goldfish was once very trendy. This is actually how sushi was first introduced to the American public. Seeing how many people you could cram into a single telephone booth came next. This fad developed when all of those people who just swallowed live goldfish rushed to the phone to call for medical assistance. Conversation used to be in. Oh, you wouldn't believe how people used to talk with each other. Families, friends, governments, nations. There was a time when everybody communicated with everybody else. Eventually, conversation went the way of most fads and just died out. Unfortunately for the world, once that happened, they came up with another fad to take its place. That fad became known as waging war. Nosegays were once very popular in Elizabethan England. They were small bouquets of aromatic herbs and flowers that women used to carry around all the time. Unlike war, this particular fad had a sensible rationale behind it. Nosegays became popular because bathing wasn't. There was a time when nobody took baths. Bathing simply wasn't in. So women, out of necessity more than anything else, took to sniffing nosegays whenever some friendly but odorous person got too close for too long. Of course, some women decided not to follow the trend and absolutely refused to carry nosegays. This group of women created another popular fad called passing out from the unbearable stench. When other women found out they could simply pass out instead of carrying nosegays, bingo, women started dropping like flies. Unfortunately, in the midst of so much passing out and falling down, people eventually forgot one interesting fact about human nature. A good mood has a distinct smell. Absolutely true. Scientists have found out that people can judge whether someone is in a positive mood from their body odor alone. Perhaps nosegays were added because of a deep-seated desire that, given a choice, humans would quite naturally wish to encounter someone who's in a good mood. Thus, a sweet scent became related to a happy scent, and the rest, as they say, became wonderful news for the personal hygiene industry. Men, on the other hand, did not adopt the practice of fainting from the smell. After all, someone had to be there to catch all of the falling women. The unfortunate backlash was that men eventually started a fad of their own and began to label women as the weaker sex. This, in itself, became a real trendy thing to do. Regrettably, but trendy. If you adopt a fad as a habit, you'll do well to remember one thing. Habits are sometimes very hard to break. Once you start to group fads in categories of gender, you're simply asking for trouble. As I said, fads can become habits before you realize it. For instance, the good Lord gave everybody tear ducts. All of us, people and elves, have the ability to cry. The trouble is, somewhere along the line, it became a fad for women only. Once crying got a feminine gender label, men naturally backed off, counteracting with that taunting sing-song admonition they occasionally aim at one another. Cry, baby, cry. Stick your finger in your eye and watch the water fly. This was a gentle but masculine reminder that women had already staked a claim on exhibiting emotion of any kind in public, so it was hands off to men. Shakespeare said, "What a piece of work is man." The boss just says, "Go figure." This brings us back to fads and how they relate to that vague Christmas morning disappointment, which has become known as the post-Christmas syndrome. Somehow you humans always manage to convince yourselves that what you want for Christmas just happens to be what everybody else wants. Imagine that. Before you rush out to list yourselves in the Guinness Book of Amazing Coincidences, however, stop long enough to consider a few things. How did you finally decide what it was you wanted, just had to have, under the tree on Christmas morning? Just sort of came to you, did it? Out of the blue? If you believe that, I've got a bridge I think you'd really be interested in buying. Some real estate in northern Siberia, too. Here's a newsflash, folks. The decision about what you want for Christmas is not made independently. The Chinese invented a unique thing known as water torture. Madison Avenue simply perfected the procedure. By the time an average American young person reaches the age of 16, he or she will already have seen 24,000 hours of television. The only thing your young people will do more than watch television is sleep. Considering you sleep for one-third of your lives, you can begin to see where your grasp on reality is factually coming from, and it's not from your heart or your head. Talk about a fad, television is definitely hot, and quite a habit with you people. Back in 1946, there were only about 10,000 television sets in the entire United States. In only 5 years, the number had grown to 12 million. Since television offers something for everybody, there was absolutely no gender problem involved. Men can see all the sports they want, and women can weep and wail over all those wonderful soap operas. Television tells you what you want to hear. Problem solved. And let's not forget your littles. Television has something for them, too. Saturday cartoons. Which brings up the question of your human fascination with mutants. What is it with you people and mutants? I know. Go figure. There's a price for all this royal entertainment spilling into millions of living rooms every hour of every day. Most fads, and habits for that matter, do come with a price. In the case of television, the price you pay comes in the form of commercials. Why do you think it's called commercial television? Of course, it's finally gotten so bad that you people have started paying money to not see so many commercials. It's called cable television, or satellite TV. They've got you coming and going. Either way, you're going to pay for what you get, which brings up the question of whether what you get is really what you want. Then, of course, you have to follow that with, is what you want really what you need? If you don't know, television will certainly tell you. And how does the advertising industry do that so well? Because it knows all about you. They know, for instance, that women tend to experience their all-time lowest life satisfaction at age 37, whereas men typically experience it at age 42. So it won't be by chance that people appearing in television commercials for drug-related remedies will be right within those age groups. By the time you get to be a biggle, you've started to develop a personal scale of values. You define goals and decide how you're going to reach them. Hopefully this is done before retirement. Littles, on the other hand, are still trying to work those things out for themselves. They're just beginning to shape their own system of values, which hopefully will take them safely and successfully through the rest of their lives. Now, in this case, parents are the first line of defense. Your laws make parents legally responsible, so the buck has been placed squarely, in most cases, on at least two sets of shoulders. The trouble with this setup is that parents just aren't there for their children 24 hours every day. On the other hand, a television set never leaves the house. It doesn't have to be in an office every day between the hours of 9 and 5. It never has to shop for food or have its hair done. It just sits there like a silent beacon in the darkness, waiting for someone with a few hours of spare time. Well, if littles have anything, it appears to be time. When most of your life is still ahead of you, it seems as if you've got all the time in the world. Once you've got time to spend, you need something to spend it on. Something convenient. One of the major determining factors as to whether or not a fad becomes a habit is the matter of convenience. That's because humans tend to worship at convenient altars. If a fad is convenient, it's got a lot better chance of becoming a habit. Television was custom made to fill this requirement. They've made it so convenient you don't even have to get out of your seat to change the channel. All you have to do is remember where the heck you put that little remote control clicker thing. Next to your incredible fascination with mutants, you've also got this thing about supply and demand. You've really gotten into a snit about having what you want when you want it. Instant gratification. Only now, in case you didn't know, you're into a situation of supply without demand, at least not right away. These days, all you really have to do is create the supply. If you do the job right and make people honestly believe that what you're supplying is the next best thing to sliced bread, it creates the demand all by itself. I mean, you keep telling somebody long enough and convincingly enough they want something, pretty soon they're going to start to believe it. Once they start to believe it, they've got to have it. You're letting television begin to define your lives, elect your leaders, tell you what to drive, who to hate, who to worship, how to dress, smell, make love, not to mention how to blow people away if they happen not to agree with you. Ever noticed that whenever somebody disagrees with somebody else on television, it's a sure bet the guns and knives are coming out in the very next scene? On a very simplistic level, it does seem to make a lot of sense. I mean, a corpse can't very well disagree with you about anything. No taxing of your intellectual or verbal skills there. But still, doesn't it all seem to you just a trifle extreme? And next to mutants and convenience, what is this thing you people have for violence and slow motion? Now don't get me wrong, there are a lot of great things on television. Those advertising guys are smart enough to know it has to have a few redeeming features. As long as they can slip episodes of Masterpiece Theater and Sesame Street in a day's lineup, they're relatively safe from mandatory warning labels, which advise you that television can be hazardous to your grasp on reality. Once some people get the idea that television is becoming an educational thing, they get very nervous. Even your elected officials start standing up in the hallowed halls of your nation's capital, drawling on about how you ought to let the government hold on to your remote controllers for you and decide what you should or shouldn't see. If your country happens to have a war going on in some corner of the world, you can bet your last nickel that you're not going to see too much ongoing news about that fact on television. That's because the powers that be have long since decided that the miracle of television should be that it takes your mind off of things. Much more alluring to watch someone else dance with a star, see who's wearing what at the Oscars, or which person's going to become the biggest loser, bachelor, bachelorette, jersey wife, chef, or bridezilla of the week. The funniest thing of all, they call it reality television. The realization will stagger you for a moment, and then you simply have to fall down laughing. Couldn't happen, you say. I don't know. It's awfully convenient. But then again, you wouldn't have to worry about having to make another decision. It's the price you pay for letting others do your thinking for you. Once you abdicate the responsibility, you're stuck with what you get. Have you ever considered the fact that if apathy is your nation's greatest problem, nobody's going to care that it's a problem? I'd say it's about time to wake up and smell the old Java. Okay, so now we've got television and Christmas, or as they say on Madison Avenue, the dynamic duo. As a potential marketing possibility, this is what's known as a match made in heaven, an advertising agent's dream. It's a cornucopia of supply, demand, instant gratification, and mind alteration all rolled into one locked and loaded blitz of holiday advertising, more lovingly recognized as, now a word from our sponsor. The first cardinal rule of television is, it's not art unless it sells it something. Hard to imagine Handel composing Messiah while harboring the ever-present knowledge that he was going to have to include periodic musical breaks so somebody could sell a can of dog food, isn't it? Of course, he could have at least consoled himself with the knowledge that not too many people would even be watching a performance of Messiah on television anyway. That's because Mr. Handel broke television's second cardinal rule. Nothing gets blown up in Messiah. There isn't a single car crash or automatic weapon in the entire piece. So the holiday season rolls around. Christmas is just around the corner, a time for peace, love, and quiet gathering of loved ones around the hearth, a time of gentle reflection, of recommitment to a world of brotherhood and universal understanding. Try telling that to the two women I once saw taking down two store display counters, clerk, and four shopping carts during a knockdown, drag-out, hair-pulling battle for possession of the toy department's last remaining Cabbage Patch doll. Those two mothers obviously hadn't gotten the message, or rather, they had been getting a message, it just happened to be the wrong one. They'd been inundated with weeks of commercial television breaks, which constantly reminded them that their daughters would never find true happiness in life if they didn't find one of those dolls under the tree on Christmas morning. Those two mothers were on a sort of single-minded crusade where "take no prisoners" had become the battle cry of the shopping day. A constantly repeated series of television sound bites and musical jingles had over a period of several weeks transformed these two women into a frightening combination of half-June Cleaver and half-Manchurian Candidate. The scary thing is they probably hadn't even noticed what was happening to them. You don't start growing hair all over your body and get claws for fingernails, but something akin to a total transformation is definitely at work. I'm certainly not saying that all of you should start viewing holiday shopping like Lon Chaney Jr. used to view the full moon. But you've all just got to become a little more aware of what's being pumped into your living rooms during this time of year. Television, turned on in the home for an average 6 hours every day, is playing so often in the background that you don't really notice it anymore. It's not there to educate or even entertain. It's just there to keep you company, fill a void. But you've got to understand what sort of subliminal effect it starts to have on everything you think, say, and do. Here's where it starts to affect what you want as opposed to what you need. For instance, let's say some pricey Madison Avenue advertising agency decides that all of you are absolutely dying to find a gift-wrapped cockroach under your tree on Christmas morning. Ridiculous, you say. Couldn't happen in a million years. Let me remind you of those pet rocks one more time. A rock that you could walk out in your yard or driveway and pick up for free. So you don't think the idea of a gift-wrapped cockroach in your Christmas stocking is too far-fetched. Not by a long shot. We've all seen it before. While it's more obvious in littles, it also has a way of creeping onto the Christmas morning face of Biggles, too. It's a look that comes from a nebulous sort of disappointment. The reason for this vague Christmas morning look of dissatisfaction is that, while they've gotten everything they asked for, they didn't ask for a single thing they honestly needed. They had abdicated their freedom to choose honestly, free from pressure. Television decided for them. It told them what they wanted. They'd been sucked into sort of a holiday junk food feeding frenzy. An hour later, it's as though they hadn't eaten a thing all day. Above all things, don't try to fake goodwill toward men. You can't do it anyway. People instinctively know when a gesture or a smile isn't genuine. If you're going to go through the motions of being happy, you might as well be happy. It takes less energy. Why does rain drop while snow falls? Doesn't matter. Both of them get to where they're going. How do you get there is your business. The thing is to get there. There's a small hand-carved sign that hangs on the north wall of the toy shop, a constant reminder to the elves who spend the greater portion of our time creating the gifts you people give each other. The little sign simply reads, "Your time, the greatest gift of all." Not a bad idea when you stop to think about it. What's the most valuable thing you can possibly give to anyone else? The most valuable thing you possess, your time. Your life contains a finite number of hours and minutes. When you've used up your allotted time, that's it. You better be ready to smile, close your eyes, or wrinkle your brow and whisper rosebud. Not all the wealth you possess can buy you one additional second. Time is positively precious. What greater gift can you possibly give to anyone than to give the one thing that's most valuable to you? Time shared with our friends and family, especially during special times of the year, is always something we want. What's more, it's always something we need. It's a gift that enriches the giver as much as the receiver. All it costs is, well, you've got to answer that for yourselves. Just remember this, the longer you wait to give it, the less you have left to give. And a lot of your valuable time is usually spent learning this lesson the hard way. If nothing else, maybe I've saved you a bit more of what we never seem to have enough of. If that's true, then allow me to stake a little claim and advise you to begin to treat your time in this world as the priceless treasure it really is. Never, ever take it for granted, or dare to think there'll be more of it later on for you or anyone else. And you can't save it up for a later date either. Little Orphan Annie was right. The sun will come out tomorrow. There's just no guarantee you'll be around to see it. A very wise person once said the only difference between a rut and a grave are their dimensions. There is no one in this world exactly like you. You're special. one of a kind. Start treating yourself that way. It has nothing to do with self-inflated pride or oversized ego. It has everything to do with fundamental truth. God put you here to accomplish something. Gandhi said, "Almost everything we do is insignificant, but it is very important that we do it." I don't think I'm overestimating the human race by making the observation that all of you would like to make the world a better place for having been here. Well, here's one way to do it. Invest your time. Because time, well invested, creates such a store of beautiful memories, moments in time that are yours forever. No one can take them away from you. When it is time for you to leave this world, memories you helped create stay behind long after you're gone. They live on in the hearts of those who knew and loved you. They are the stories people will tell about you, the things your grandchildren will pass along to your grandchildren. Sooner or later, there will come a time when you will be merely a memory. Your life and everything you were will be finally caught and held in a few precious and treasured remembrances. The wondrous potential of that legacy is in your hands right now, this very moment. Why do elves work day in and day out in the North Pole toy shop? The answer is we don't. The way we figure it, work is simply something you don't like to do. So we don't work, we give our time to what we love. Because of that, elves never manage to waste a second of their lives. Our time on this earth becomes an ongoing gift we exchange with each other. And in that joyous exercise, we reaffirm the glorious knowledge that life is a pleasure and living should be nothing less than a celebration of the gift of time. So, get up off that sofa. Turn the television set off for a while. You'll get over the withdrawal. Don't put your love off, put it into action. Stop giving first-class attention to second-class causes. Go ahead. Live like there isn't going to be a tomorrow. Wish a stranger Merry Christmas. Smile a little more. Have some fun again. Be healthier by being happier. All feelings, including happiness, depend on the brain's receiving and processing signals from the body. Your heart beats an additional 3 to 5 heartbeats a minute when you're happy. Happiness also improves blood circulation, causes your skin temperature to rise, and makes your muscles relax. That's a win-win no-brainer by anyone's standards. Just remember along the way, in case you never ever need it, the wonderful lesson old Ebenezer Scrooge learned. Some people laughed to see the alteration in him, but he let them laugh and little heeded them, for he was wise enough to know that never ever happened on this globe for good at which some people did not have their fill of laughter in the outset, and knowing that such as these would be blind anyway, he thought it quite as well that they should wrinkle up their eyes in grins as have the malady in less attractive forms. His own heart laughed, and that was quite enough for him.
And that brings us to the end of the second hour of Ira David Wood III's Confessions of an Elf. So, if you need to step away, step away. We've got about 6 or 7 minutes before we'll be starting the third hour. If you don't need to step away, sit back, listen up. Robin Bullock's got some more Guitar for Christmas. Okay, folks, we'll be coming back in about another minute here, so if anybody else has stepped away, make sure you call them back. We need everybody here at the top of the hour.